Well, from the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM, America's most listened to number one overnight talk show. Actually, North America, I should say. Have to include Canada. Well, next hour, Robert Miles, the Fast Walkers. Now, that's a code apparently used by NORAD to classify UFOs which approach planet Earth. We're going to be bringing in each half hour with Robert a number of different guests as well who are experts in the ufology field. It's going to be a fascinating program. First, some news of the night. Former President Gerald Ford is dead at the age of 93 years old. Gerald R. Ford, who picked up the pieces of Richard Nixon's scandal-shattered White House as the 38th and only unelected president in America's history, has died. Ford had battled pneumonia in January of this year and underwent two heart treatments, including angioplasty, in August at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He was the longest living president, followed by Ronald Reagan, who also died at 93. Ford had been living at his desert home in Rancho Mirage, California. Now that's about 130 miles east of Los Angeles. Former President Ford was an accidental president. Nixon's hand-picked successor, a man of much political experience who had never run on a national ticket. He was open, straightforward, as Nixon was tightly controlled and conspiratorial. He took office minutes after Nixon flew off into exile and declared, "Our long national nightmare is over." But he revived the debate a month later by granting Nixon a pardon for all the crimes he committed as president. That single act, it was widely believed, cost Ford election to a term of his own in 1976. But later it won him praise, years later, as a courageous act that allowed the nation to move on to heal. Gerald R. Ford, dead at the age of 93. A commercial jet plane carrying British Prime Minister Tony Blair and his family slightly overshot a runway at the Miami International Airport tonight, but the plane was not damaged, no injuries reported. British Airways Flight 209 from London ran over a couple airfield lights after landing around 6:15 p.m., but did not leave the pavement and returned to the gate under its own power. A very strong undersea earthquake of magnitude 7.1 struck off Taiwan, followed by a powerful aftershock, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. No damage or injuries were immediately reported, but correspondents say the quake could be felt across the island. Japan's meteorological agency says the danger of a tsunami heading for the Philippines has passed. The tremors come on the second anniversary of the Asian tsunami, which claimed almost 250,000 lives. In Iraq, an Iraqi appeals court has upheld the death sentence imposed on Saddam Hussein at his first trial, and a tribunal official said the verdict will be carried out even if the presidency doesn't ratify it. On November 5th, an Iraqi court sentenced Saddam to the gallows for the 1982 killings of 148 people from a Shiite Muslim town after an attempt on his life there. The appeals court decision must be ratified by President Jalal Talabani and Iraq's two vice presidents. Talabani opposes the death penalty, but has in the past deputized a vice president to sign an execution order on his behalf, a substitute that was legally accepted. Once the decision is ratified, Saddam and other co-defendants sentenced to death at the trial would be hanged within 30 days. Cuban President Fidel Castro is recovering from ailments and does not have cancer, according to a Spanish surgeon who met with him and consulted with the leader's medical team. Castro, he says, is doing fantastically well with treatment. The doctor, the chief of surgery at a public hospital, made that statement. Castro's 80 years old. He underwent intestinal surgery on July 31st. He has not been seen in public since. The Cuban government has released at least one video of him. A key antenna on Japan's largest satellite has failed to unfold successfully due to a technical glitch. The agency had planned to use the satellite for communications to conduct sensitive measurements of time, calibrating a high-precision clock on board and similar clocks on ground. In New Zealand, a 27-year-old woman seriously injured after she was hit by a leaping dolphin. The dolphin just popped right out of the water and hit the woman, giving her a number of injuries. If you go to the coasttocoastam.com website, look under Hot Stories. I will not go through them all, but there are some of the 10 most bizarre people on Earth. Read all about them. Here's one guy who's gone 3 decades without sleep. Another had his twin brother in his stomach. Another spent 28 years hidden after World War II. He thought things were still going on. There's another guy who lives at an airport. He's been there since 1988. A Japanese person believes he's Jesus Christ. Another man, officially dead, but he's still alive. David Icke, he's in it because of his views on reptilians. And it goes on and on. Go take a look at the story. Hot stories, coasttocoastam.com. The chief executive of the Ford Motor Company apparently met with the chairman of Toyota as the first step in a potential partnership negotiation. Just what is happening to the old U.S. automobile industry? Well, in a moment, an expert, Paul Mueller, we're going to talk with Paul not only about his Sky car, but about the U.S. automobile industry, and we're going to check in to see if it's collapsing. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Dr. Paul Mueller, you know him. He's the founder, chairman of the board, has served as president of the Mueller International since its formation in 1983. Mueller International was formed to develop a powered lift aircraft called the Sky Car and other related technologies. He holds a master's in engineering, PhD from McGill University. He was a professor of mechanical and aeronautical engineering at the University of California, Davis from 63 to 75. And he founded the Supertrap Industries, which became the most recognized international name in high-performance engine silencing systems. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast. Hey, Paul, I never had an opportunity to chat with you. It's my pleasure. How are you?
Good to meet you, too. I feel good. Thanks.
Good. Before we get back into the Sky Car and get an update from you, General Motors was holding negotiations, I believe, with Nissan for a possible merger. It looks like Ford and Toyota. What's happening, Paul, to the United States automobile industry?
Well, I don't know. They've been going south for a long time. I think probably it's wrapped up in the statement that GM made a number of years ago. I think it was about 5 years ago, where they said, we will never build a hybrid car. And, of course, now when they face the facts that hybrid cars have a real future in America and the world in general, they've got to go back sort of on their knees to talk to the Japanese about something that they could have very well done themselves a long time ago.
It is sad. I mean, the Japanese cars, those companies seem to be showing record profits all the time. Their quarters far exceed what we're doing here in the United States. We're shutting down plants, laying off people. The Japanese keep rolling along. How could they take our technology, our ideas, years ago, and do a better job? What happened? How did we lose it here?
Well, these big industries, when they really get big and they get so entrenched, imagination seems to go out the door. And really, that's the situation in General Motors and Ford for some time. I mean, if you go back many years, Chrysler had a turbine car in the 60s that was really impressive, and the people would have loved to have kept that car, but they did 300 of them. Everybody loved them, but they took them back off the road again and decided they really didn't want to change the old formula.
If you're running Ford or GM, would you have fired some people, some executives, and said, look, I'm going to bring in some people who are thinkers?
Well, I don't know this. The corporate structure is such that it's probably difficult for one person, even the president, to do what we might like to do in a situation like that. I have a very hard time understanding why we can't be more imaginative when we get large. It seems that sometimes the creativity goes south when a company gets beyond a certain size.
Hey, Paul, is the ball game over for the United States automobile industry? I mean, should we just basically throw in the towel?
I think so. I think that these talks right now really express the fact that the only chance that Ford or GM has, in my opinion, is to join with Toyota and perhaps Honda or one other company. But I don't understand why they really want to join the American industry other than perhaps to have greater access to the market. Maybe some different models that combine both companies. But really, you notice the stock today of Ford went up in this talk, and the stock of Toyota went down. So clearly, that pretty much emphasizes what the two companies think of the prospects. Ford needs it. Toyota doesn't, in my opinion.
Paul, my father used to work at Ford Motor Company. He was a financial analyst all his life. I mean, he never went anyplace else. And, you know, he accumulated a lot of shares of Ford stock. He was the kind of guy never to sell, always buy. And at one point, Ford stock was selling in the mid-40s. I remember a couple of years ago, I said, Dad, just sell it all and put it in the bank and do something else. And he said, oh, no, George, I love this company. And, of course, it plummeted, and with it went his fortunes. It was sad. He's 82 years old now, and thank God he doesn't look at the all the stocks like he used to, because he used to look at it on a daily basis. You are right. It is gone. The heyday of the automobile industry in the United States, it's all over.
Well, think. I'm sure your readers or your listeners have heard about, you know, who killed electric car. This is an electric car that was called the EV1, built by General Motors, and was really built by General Motors because California mandated electric cars. A very successful car. They built thousands of them. Everybody who bought one loved it. But General Motors decided they really didn't want electric cars because it couldn't make enough profit for them. And so they went to California and got them to kick that law back out again, took all those cars and went out and squashed them in the junkyards, took them away from all the people who almost cried. In fact, they protested for a great length of time. This was a great car, but GM decided it didn't make enough profit quickly enough.
You know, and I've always heard horror stories. Some people would even call Coast to Coast and say, yeah, I heard a story years ago. Somebody invented a carburetor that would get 200 miles to the gallon. And one of the automobile industries, you know, one of the companies bought it and they shelved the technology. I don't know if that's true or not, Paul, but I could believe it.
I don't think that particular case is true. It's great you exaggerated, because we do have certain laws of physics that wouldn't allow that to be possible. But certainly the electric car is true. That's a factual situation. We have the evidence to support the fact that we had a very successful car that was killed by General Motors. There's no doubt about that.
Why can't we, as a nation, turn this around and simply, you know, get our people back to work, get the factories going again, and come up with innovative product, innovative ideas, vehicles, and we'll talk about the Sky Car in just about 10 minutes or so, but come up with some innovation here, alternative fuels, in programs where we can get new vehicles, and go for it. Why won't we do that?
Honestly, I think it's so, we've been down in this situation of copying and looking at the 6-month bottom line for so long. I don't think they've got this 5-year mentality. A really good example was when Toyota was developing their hybrid car. General Motors said, you know, these guys are fools. Oh, you know, we're going to lose money for 5 years putting out a hybrid car. And they were right. Toyota lost money for the first number of years. They lost about $5,000 per car because they were really buying the market. They knew that they had to get the volume up to get the price down, but they were willing to do that. Ford thought about 6 months in the electric car and said, you know, we're not going to make money in 6 months. Let's get out of it.
Toyota sales jumped by 13% this year. Ford's dropped by 8%. They're projecting that they will unseat Ford as the number two U.S. market maker probably as soon as next year. I would assume, Paul, that if there's some kind of merger or some kind of marriage here, I would think Toyota would emerge as the powerful company out of the two. They would probably be the controlling interest here, don't you
think? Absolutely. No question about it. There is no doubt that would be the case. There's no other way, because there's no reason for Toyota to get involved unless they were controlling it.
Would we lose more jobs here in the United States?
Not necessarily. Toyota has plants in the United States that are building wonderful cars very successfully. Everybody's happy. They love the labor rules that they're running with, the health plan and everything else. So they can compete in the United States building cars. So I think that if they really had control, they might save the American industry.
So it's possible we might get more jobs out of this deal.
It's possible, although there's going to be a lot of losses initially, which Ford has already recognized. GM and Ford are dropping huge numbers of people. But with that starting point, I think the chances are that it can be stopped and even reversed if we can make the industry survive through the help of the Japanese in this case, which is a terrible thing to admit, actually, quite frankly.
Some people, Paul, say the economy's rolling along. Other people say, no, it's not. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, certainly. certainly certain segments of it are rolling along, but we're primarily a service country right now. We certainly are not a manufacturing country, and we're even losing some of our services. I think that we have some serious problems, but we seem to be a very survivable country, and I believe in that.
So the Skycar, how long have you been working on that now? What's going on with that?
I never like to admit how long I've been working on it, but the problem with this kind of technology is it may be a little like the hybrid car industry. It is an expensive technology to develop, and if you can't get money for hybrid cars in America, you can imagine what my probability is getting money for something like a Skycar, which is even further away than hybrid cars.
So we can't say that it is lifted off the ground yet.
Well, it's lifted off the ground, but it hasn't reached the point where it's ready for production. We've flown them remotely, and of course, I've flown earlier versions over the top of my building and all around Davis, around the plant in Davis. But I have not got a car that you could take tomorrow and put into production. Clearly, there's more money required, and I've got to find the right kind of partner to make that happen.
Okay, well, you just might with the Japanese. You never know, because it's a novel idea. How would it work, Paul? Tell me the concept of the Skycar.
Well, the Skycar is not something to replace automobiles in general. What it would is offload the highway system of a lot of 50 miles and more travel trips we make, which is about 50% of the traffic today. So it would change our lifestyle in certain ways, give us more freedom, get us off the highway in many cases, and leave more room on the highway for other people and trucks. It's primarily a hybrid, I would call it a hybrid vehicle. It's a rotable aircraft in the sense that it flies like a aircraft, but it can be driven on the highway for short distances. Certainly not a car that flies. It's more an aircraft that's rotable.
And how high could it go?
Well, that's a trade-off. If you're going from Sacramento to San Francisco, which is about 70 miles, you'd probably go to 5,000 feet. If you're going from Sacramento to L.A., you'd probably go to 25,000 feet, because the higher you fly, the faster you can fly for the same amount of fuel burn.
I see. Okay, now what are the possibilities? I mean, we see accidents every day in Los Angeles. What are the possibilities of all these flying cars smashing into each other?
Well, I think the interesting thing about this is that there is no world of flying cars per se unless the highway in the sky is in place, and that's a completely automated network that's going in place as we speak. What that would allow you to do is to get in this vehicle, whether it's one of our vehicles or a similar type vehicle in the next few years, and just program, basically ask where the city you want to go. You put in a number, and you go to sleep, you play computer games, you read. You're not going to be flying or controlling this vehicle. Blind people could use it. Handicapped people could use it. It would be a vehicle that would really deliver you, maybe like we deliver a cruise missile in Iraq successfully, but can't put a car on the highway in America that works with a damn.
Amazing. I mean, it looks like the Jetsons. It reminds me of that.
Well, it's certainly, there's no reason technologically we are not able to do this. It clearly does require that highway, because it would be a little like the automobile at the turn of the century. If we didn't have a highway system, we really had the horses working a lot better than cars for a long time. But when you have the highway in the sky, which we can create a lot faster than we can create on a highway on the ground, then you really have the opportunity to use vehicles like this and to change our lifestyle in the process.
What about inclement weather, Paul? Would vehicles like this, would they still go up there?
Well, there would be certain situations where you wouldn't go into a thunderstorm, but the vehicle itself has, you know, I would get a little technical for those who are listening that might be technical. It has a very high wing loading and a short span wing, so it's, and it has artificial stabilization. So for most situations, it would be more stable than anything that's flying today, but it still wouldn't survive, in my opinion, in the worst of thunderstorms, so you'd certainly avoid those.
Would it have the capability of coming down via parachute in case something technical happened to it?
We do have built-in parachutes, but obviously that would be a last resort kind of a situation. We have multiple engines and multiple computers, and the view is that we could fail a number of components in the aircraft and continue to fly. So we hope that the parachute is really there for the psychological benefit during the startup, but undoubtedly it'll be used occasionally.
But you can't walk to your local gas station if you run out of fuel.
You could. It burns gasoline just fine, but our choice is ethanol, which is what we use at the moment. It burns a lot cleaner. It certainly puts out less emissions. So we've always used ethanol in our sky cars.
So primarily it's a plane as opposed to a car. What are the percentages of being in the air as opposed to on the ground?
Oh, I'd say 99.9% in the air. You know, the real convenience is that you could drive it from your home to a vertiport, which may be a block, a couple blocks, maybe a mile or so away, and then take off. So you wouldn't, you could really use it in a complete broad way. And I think maybe someday, 10, 15 years from now, with people's flat roof houses, you could land it at your home. But for the moment, I think it'll probably be using a vertiport rather than...
That's amazing. Okay, Paul, stay with us. I'm going to open up the phone lines. We'll give you an opportunity to talk to the originator of the Sky Car, Paul Muller. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, get the January issue of the After Dark newsletter. It's on predictions. This is going to be a classic. And to make things even more unbelievable, you get a double CD, an old Art Bell interview with the late Father Malachi Martin, two separate shows, Perfect Possession and Exorcisms and Demons. Those two CDs, those shows are free when you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter by calling 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Paul Muller. Your phone calls, Paul's website, linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. Paul, if you had to guess, probability of getting the Sky Car built and in the marketplace, what do you think?
I would say 5 years, there'll be limited numbers of them out there. With 10, there'll be very significant numbers, nothing near automotive levels. I think that you won't see automotive levels probably for another 20 years. By that, I mean, you know, when you start, you know, we build, you know, tens of millions of automobiles in America, and we build worldwide, you know, something near 40 million a year. So those are numbers that are, you know, decades and decades away. But certainly as a significant factor in our transportation system, perhaps initially as an air taxi more than personal use, where you're sort of on demand rather than on schedule. So you're not ending up stuck in an airport indefinitely, because when you've got four people or six people or whatever, the vehicle leaves. I think that's the initial place it'll start. This is at least Boeing's viewpoint on how it could be used.
You need to get someone like Richard Branson involved with you. I mean, he's aggressive enough.
He is. In fact, we're talking to his COO at this time and have a good rapport going. So that may lead very well to something. It's quite a successful conversation we've had so far.
Well, okay, let's go to some of the other calls. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I was in the car business. I'm a mechanic. My father, rest his soul, is a Chrysler Plymouth Master technician. And I think our engineers and our people are just as innovative as anybody else is anywhere, maybe even more so. But don't we suffer, as George, I think you touched on, the entrenched bureaucracy by the fact that these people, the Japanese car companies are still family-owned businesses, even though they're publicly traded, but the people that built and maintain, you know, is still within the family under control. Well, we cede our, you know, big companies to people who have no personal stake other than their own bonuses and their own bonus structure, and then if they screw up the entire company, ruin people's lives or an industry, they walk away with money in their pocket and don't care.
Millions in their pocket.
Yeah, I really agree with that. The comments of the listener, I've seen that over and over again. They were commenting today how these executives get hundreds of millions of dollars, even when the company is going south. And this idea of family-owned, or at least a vested interest, and the reputation is very important. And with these people, when they're part of the company, they take pride in the company in a very direct sense. If the company fails, they feel like they failed, and that's not true here in many cases.
Paul, I've always been a supporter of the American working man and woman. I'm raised in Detroit, so, you know, I understand labor unions. I witnessed the Teamsters, the United Automobile Workers. I remember when Walter Reuther died in a plane crash in Michigan. The question, I guess, is, as some people will say, however, that pension plans and big unions ruined the automobile industry. Is that true, or can we blame everybody?
I think you really need to blame everybody. I mean, that is a factor. Certainly, the load from on the part of the unions and the cost that go with that is significant. But independent of that, it's still, if you look at the amount of hours it takes to build a car in America, it's still significantly higher at General Motors than it is Toyota. So that's efficiency. That's not unions. That's pure efficiency. So there are many other factors besides unions, which aren't that strong today. I mean, they were strong in the past, and they did lead up to this situation in part that exists today, but I don't think that's a significant factor any longer.
All right, next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, Samantha from Princeton, Minnesota.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on, long-time listener. Kudos to my dad for introducing me to you, George.
Okay, I love it.
Ray Toy, if you're out there, love you, Dad. I just have a question. Are these cars, you know, it sounds awesome. I'm really excited to hear, you know, the whole Jetson era coming around. But are they going to be family practical? I mean, I have a family of six. I mean, are you envisioning moms, you know, running to soccer practice and back and forth and, you know, jumping in these cars and doing that kind of thing? Or are these going to be more for some high-end executives with their, you know, pads down in the metro area and their, like you were saying, the flat roofs and landing them? You know, what kind of envisioning...
Well,
you know,
I think
do you have for this?
You know, initially, of course, they'll be more expensive because they won't be produced in large numbers. The automobile industry, you know, at the turn of the century, the cars were very expensive until Ford got the numbers
right up.
But the vehicle we're building right now is a four-passenger vehicle. It certainly would be affordable if produced in large numbers. Now, it's not something you're going to go to soccer practice, and it's not for, you know, 2 blocks or 2 miles. This is the kind of vehicle you want to use if you want to go get away from the city, or you want to live outside the city, those kinds of options.
Longer trips, you're thinking?
Yeah, 50-mile trips, perhaps,
okay,
which is about 50% of all miles traveled. So it'll be very effective for that, and it'll give you a different degree of freedom from anything you enjoy today in that regard. But it's in the middle. It's not the soccer game, but it's certainly not for the rich people either.
Well, great. You know, I really encourage you. Anything we can do to get out of our oil consumption and get away from this gas guzzling that we're doing, you know, you're doing a good job.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Have a great night.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. What about licensing of people? I mean, we know what you got to do to get a license to drive a car. How about one of these sky cars?
Well, again, if this is as automated as I think it has to be, where the human is not involved other than selecting where he wants to go, there really wouldn't be licensing. Clearly, when you're up there, everybody's going to know who you are and why you're there and where you're going, and they're going to know exactly where you are at all times, which maybe changed security in America in a very favorable way. But as far as the requirements, the skill level, I'm the test pilot right now. I've never had a pilot's license, and I've never had an accident in this vehicle, and I've done a lot of flying in it, more often than not with a tether, but a lot of times without a tether as well. So it does not require any degree of skill, and it never will. It just needs to be completely organized so that you don't have to worry about somebody else out there doing something stupid.
Paul, if for some reason something happened to this automated grill system, would we be able to override it and fly it manually?
Well, you wouldn't be able to override it, but the vehicle itself would have enough built-in sense, because it isn't just the GPS system that you'd be using. I mean, you'd be using that and a lot of other things. But if something were to go wrong, you would just drop out of the highway sky system and be brought down to the land in a built-in program that would deal with that. Again, you wouldn't want the human to take over, because even just escaping from an emergency, he could kill a lot of people.
Well, that's true. And you wouldn't plop down on somebody's car or anything like that. The system
right.
would get you onto the road.
It would pick you a spot. I mean, we have the ability to pick the
good
spot.
Good luck in Los Angeles to find a spot when you're coming down.
That's true.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hello, my name is Jeff, a long-time listener.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for calling.
Not a problem. I had a quick question. I drive a truck for a living, and I was wondering if there was if they were, you know, planning on doing commercial vehicles that fly as well, or if that's just totally out of the question.
Well, it is it is very difficult to lift any kind of weight vertically up, and that is the key element in the Sky Car, the fact you can take off theoretically from your backyard. So that is not going to be what's called a heavy lift vehicle. A helicopter would be better at that. It'll lift a family of six in our biggest model and possibly a family of eight in a somewhat bigger model, but that's the limit. So it probably never is going to be capable of lifting more than 3/4 of a ton.
I have job security then.
You certainly do. You absolutely do.
Because you were saying that you can program them to where they're going to go and everything, so that would pretty much eliminate my job. So that's why I was really concerned about it.
What I'm going to do is...
Go ahead.
I'm going to help you keep your job, because what will happen is that we're going to get these cars off the road so you have a place to drive, because what's going to happen in these highway systems in the future is there's not going to be any room for trucks because it's going to be so jammed up. So we've got to get the roads offloaded so the trucks can get our produce to market.
Gotcha. And one more question. Do you have any idea of how much, like, the four-passenger vehicle that you were talking about is going to be, or can you not, you know, do you
how
have any idea?
How much is going to cost?
Just like a rough estimate when they do come out, what they would
Jeff
cost.
Sounds like you're saving already.
Well, it's something I've been thinking about for, like, my entire life, you know what I'm saying, ever since the Jetsons, like you guys were talking about.
Well, I'm going to give you predictions because, again, they're just predictions. But it's produced in the levels of, say, the Mustang car. That was about 350,000 cars per year. We could get the price down to about $65,000.
Now, they're not going to be that bad.
It seems high, but remember, aircraft don't depreciate like cars. You lose about 2% per year rather than 10% per year. So $65,000 for an airplane is about $30,000 in a car as far as the cost to you.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate everything.
Great. Thanks. Appreciate your call, Jeff. Plus, you could probably get, for this Sky Car, 10-year financing as opposed to, what is it now, 6 years max, maybe 5 years?
You know, that's interesting you say that because, of course, the Sky Car looks like it looks because it has to look like that to be efficient. And so you don't change the styling every year because you don't have that option. So it's going to be the vehicle that's going to look good in, you know, 2007 is going to look good in 2017.
Well, you got to bring one down to Coast Studios, Paul, and we'll test drive it. I'll put Art Bell and I in one of those, and off we go.
I look forward to that.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Ed from Lansing, Michigan.
Hi, Ed. Thanks.
Hi. Well, I got a couple of questions for Paul. One, I'd like to know whatever sparked the idea that got him started down this path. And my second question is why wouldn't this product be something that could be marketable to the airline industry in a contract form, much like the government does with the companies that, you know, provide our fighter jets?
Well, to answer your first question, I got started as a kid on a mountaintop in Canada in the dead of winter trying to be like a hummingbird. And I recognized that the only way I was going to get to school was to learn to fly like a hummingbird. And that really got me enthusiastic about something that could do what the hummingbird does. And I guess that's 65 years ago. As far as contracting the vehicle, I think that the study done by Boeing about the Sky Car really puts into perspective. They really believe that a vehicle like this would be an excellent air taxi, something that you could rent or someone could arrive at your doorstep, pick you up, and perhaps not even have a pilot on board, just arrive and you get in it and be delivered exactly where you want to go.
Well, yeah, that sounds very intriguing because I envision in the airlines now, you know, people don't like the crowded planes and the cramped quarters, and it would be like having your own personal flight.
Exactly, and the study even by Boeing showed that the cost would be no greater than the commercial airlines today because the cost of our fuel is a lot less because we use so much less, and you don't sit a lot of time taxiing on an airport. When you're ready to go, you go. So there's a lot of savings in fuel that way. So it's already and goes directly from A to B rather than some circular route.
Right. Well, I've been following this. I've got an original copy of the Popular Mechanics article that came out in the 80s. And I've been really intrigued by this all these years. And you don't hear a lot about it too often, but I was certainly glad to hear it on the show tonight. And kudos to George and Art and all them for this show. They've just a wonderful show.
All right. Well, thank you, Ed.
Thank you. Yeah, if he likes to, you know, our new website is up with a lot of new details at Moeller.com, so he could go to that and learn a lot more about it if he wanted to.
And that's Moeller, right, Paul?
Right.
Okay. How did you get this idea, and how did it come to you?
Well, as I say, initially I was inspired when I was 5 years old by the hummingbird, but I knew that vertical takeoff, the ability to take off from your backyard, is critical to the use of something like this by everybody. And so initially I got designing helicopters when I was about 15. And then I decided that really, I went to a trade school where I learned to rivet and weld and do the things that were necessary to actually build these vehicles. And then just one thing led to another. And I have to admit, I didn't think it was going to take me this length of time. But what I'm doing is very dependent on other technologies. The computers that we do today or develop today are so critical. These very strong materials that are needed for making a very lightweight vehicle. And, of course, we had to develop an engine. That was probably the most difficult thing. We had to develop our own engine because there was no engine that was available that would do what we wanted to do.
Is it noisy when it's working?
No, actually, we have developed a new engine called a compound version of it, which is very, very quiet. In fact, when we run it on the dyno in our shop, I don't even know the engine's running. It's a new technology that we're pretty excited about.
All right, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the show. Go ahead, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine.
Good, thank you.
Sir, I'm not going to take a lot of your time. I'm actually going to just make a point and then hang up and listen to your comment. My job, about 80% of my job, is dealing directly with the Japanese industry, and I don't mean the automotive. There's a myriad of industries that I deal with. And I have the great experience and opportunity to travel to Japan, to Osaka, Kyoto, and Tokyo, back and forth, and it forced me to learn the language. I did spend some time in Hong Kong, and I can tell you that without fear of any contradiction, I have seen the future, and I seriously do not believe that America is in it. I have the extreme anxiety that we are leagues behind these people, and that they are focusing on the next 50, 100, and 150 years. I honestly believe that they will be dominating the automobile industry as well as several other industries, and I just wanted to hear your comment on that. Thanks again.
All right, thank you, and we've got about a minute and a half, 2 minutes to go, Paul.
Yeah, well, he is correct. I just came back from China myself, and the Chinese have asked me if I would go over there and help them set up a program in vertical takeoff aircraft at the universities. We're shutting down our programs in America. One of the few universities that have a program is the University of California, Davis, which I started many, many years ago. But we have put all our money into outer space. We've stopped doing research in aeronautics. At the same time, the Chinese are opening up the universities and creating tens of thousands of aeronautical engineers. And you can't even get a job as an aeronautical engineer in most cases in America right now because we don't have anything going on. It's a very, very sad comment. I think your listener, your speaker, is absolutely right.
And we put in all our money and technology and the weaponry. I am convinced, Paul, that this entire plan is geared to a one-world government where different factions of other countries will do other things and do them very well. We may be the policemen of the world. China may be the producers of product. The Japanese may be something else. I'm convinced, just with what he said about how we have let this lapse, how we've let this get away, I think this is a one-world government plan. And our role is to be the military cops on the street.
That's an expensive role.
It is an expensive role. I agree with that.
We got to find a way to make money so we can do that.
That's exactly right. Hey, Paul, I want to thank you for being on the program. You're a delight. I always used to just enjoy hearing you talk with Paul, and thanks for coming on the program.
You're welcome. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Okay. It's Paul Moeller, and he's been a great guest of Art Bell's for years here on Coast to Coast. Well, when I come right back, we're going to be talking with Robert Miles, because the next program you're going to hear in just a few minutes, called Fast Talkers and Fast Walkers. I'm the Fast Talker. Up next, the Fast Walker.